a burden on others. These thoughts are powerful, but ask yourself this. If someone you loved, an uncle or daughter, a favorite colleague, were in the situation you find yourself in, would you think it was okay for them to ask for help? Why should you be held to a different standard? If part of your identity is believing that you don't need help, then asking for it is never going to be easy. And when you do ask, not everyone will come through for you, and that will be painful. But many people will. And by trusting them enough to ask, you offer them an extraordinary opportunity to do something important for someone they care about. Then one day, you may have the opportunity to return the favor.
What's your purpose? When to raise it and when to let go? You can't have every difficult conversation you come across. Life is too short, the list too long. So how do you decide when to have a conversation, for the first time or the 15th? And how do you let go of the issues you decide not to raise? These are the questions that torment us as we lie awake, listening to that barking dog next door. We've spent the first half of this program talking about what you might raise. We'll spend the next half outlining how. But before we get to that, is there anything we can say about when? It would be easy if there were some hard and fast rules about when to raise issues and when to leave well enough alone. Never talk politics at the dinner table. Whatever you do, don't raise anything before 8 a.m. And never disagree with your boss. All have the advantage of being clear rules, although not particularly helpful. Because the specifics of each situation are different, there is no simple rule we can offer to guide you in making a wise decision. What we can offer are a few questions and suggestions to help you sort through whether and how you might initiate a conversation. In every case, work through the three conversations as best you can. Get a better handle on your feelings, key identity issues, and possible distortions or gaps in your perceptions. Think clearly about what you do know, your own feelings, your own experiences and story, your identity issues, and about what you don't know, their intentions, their perspective or feelings. This approach will help you become more aware of the process of communication and gain insight into what's making your conversations difficult. Sometimes the insights you find will present a clear answer. Raising this is important, and now I have some ideas about how to do it differently. Or, now I'm starting to see why having a conversation probably won't help. In making that choice wisely, three key questions stand out. First, ask yourself, is the real conflict inside me? Sometimes what's difficult about the situation has a whole lot more to do with what's going on inside you than what's going on between you and the other person. In that case, a conversation focused on the interaction isn't going to be very illuminating or productive, at least until you've had a longer conversation with yourself. Insight into her identity conversation helped Carmen resolve a running dispute with her husband over responsibility for managing a variety of kid-related activities, such as carpool schedules, doctor's appointments, and piano lessons.
Despite the fact that I was working full-time to support the family while Tom stayed home with the kids, I was still doing much of the scheduling and running around. I felt like Tom wasn't responsible enough. As I saw it, he kept dropping the ball, so I had to pick it up and make sure things ran smoothly. But then when I started sorting through my identity conversation, I started seeing the ways in which I was keeping control of this part of the kids' lives. Maybe because of my ambivalence about working full-time. I love my job. I'm good at it, and I make decent money. But I'm still nagged by guilt, and there are times when I'm jealous, because my daughter often goes to Tom with problems before she comes to me.
Once Carmen realized that taking responsibility for the scheduling was her way of assuring herself that she was still a good mother, still involved and essential to her children's well-being, she was able to let go of the resentment she felt when things got hectic.
I both turned some things over to Tom and shifted the way I thought about these responsibilities. These are things I've chosen to take on, to stay involved, rather than things he's let slide.
A second key question in deciding whether or not to initiate a conversation is there a better way to address the issue than talking about it? As you sort out your feelings or identify your contribution to a situation, it may become clear that what's called for is not a conversation about the interaction, but for you to initiate a change in your behavior. Sometimes actions are better than words. Walter had endured a series of difficult conversations with his mother over the family farm located in northern Missouri. He tells the family story. "Ever since Dad died, my brothers have been helping my mother run the place. Whenever I talk with her, she asks when I'm going to come home and join the family business, or at least take old Doc Denny's job as the town doctor. I enjoy living in St. Louis, where I have a terrific pediatric practice, so the conversation I thought I needed to have more successfully was telling my mom to accept that I'm not coming back, at least not anytime soon. But as I sorted through the three conversations, I discovered some things. I realized that in addition to feeling frustrated and resentful when my mother raises this issue, I also felt appreciative that she misses me, and grateful that I have roots and the option to return. And I felt sad that my kids weren't developing the close relationship with their grandmother that my nieces have, and they were also missing out on the chance to grow up on a farm, which was a wonderful experience for me. One of the most important insights came from imagining my mother's perceptions and feelings. Suddenly it occurred to me that what my mom was really saying was that she missed knowing what was going on with me, being part of our lives. But when she would express this by asking when I'd come home, I usually reacted by cutting the conversation short. Then I wouldn't call her back for weeks on end, simply because I dreaded having to discuss the issue again. So I ended up contributing to her feeling even more disconnected, which in turn would prompt her to express how much she missed us, and we'd go around again. Once Walter sorted out this contribution system and the complexity of his feelings, he realized that he didn't need to have a conversation with his mother about how often she asked if he was coming home. He first needed to change his contribution to the problem. "I began phoning Mom more often, sending her short notes about the kids' activities, and inviting her to visit in St. Louis just for fun, rather than for a holiday or a family event. When she raised the question of when I might come home, instead of cutting the conversation short, I shared how satisfying my practice was, and also my feelings of regret and confusion about not getting to spend more time with the family, and also about wishing that the kids could spend more time with her. This actually prompted an invitation for my daughters to spend the summer with their cousins on the farm, and slowly the questions about my return began to decrease." And not surprisingly, Walter grew closer to his mother. The last key question in deciding whether or not to initiate a conversation is, do you have purposes that make sense? Imagine asking the head of NASA about the purpose of a particular space mission and getting the answer, I don't know. We thought we'd launch someone into space and figure things out from there. Not likely. Yet we often launch into our conversations in much the same way. We find ourselves in the middle of the conversation, and neither person is quite sure what the point is or what a good outcome would look like. Other times, we try having conversations when our purposes are simply off base. When that happens, whatever you say or do is not going to help and might even make things worse, because you've chosen a destination that it's impossible to reach. Remember, you can't change other people. In many situations, our purpose in initiating a conversation is to get the other person to change. There's nothing wrong with hoping for change. The urge to change others is universal. We want them to be more loving, to show more appreciation for our hard work, to give us more personal space, to be more social at parties, to accept our career choice or our sexual orientation, to believe in our God or our views on important issues of the day. The problem is, we can't make these things happen. We can't change someone else's mind or force them to change their behavior. If we could, many difficult conversations would simply vanish. Think about it. How often do you change your values and beliefs, or who you love, or what you want in life, based on something someone else tells you? And how likely are you to do so when the person who's trying to change you doesn't seem fully aware of the reasons you see things differently in the first place? We can have influence on other people, but here we need to be especially careful. The paradox is that trying to change someone rarely results in change. On the other hand, engaging someone in a conversation where mutual learning is the goal often does result in change. Why? Because when we set out to try to change somebody, we are more likely to argue with and attack their story and less likely to listen. This approach increases the likelihood that they will feel defensive rather than open to learning something new. They are more likely to change if they think we understand them and if they feel heard and respected. They are more likely to change if they feel free not to. Another common mistake is acting to relieve psychological tension in the short term at the cost of creating a worse situation in the future. Janet learned this the hard way. With 20 years of experience in nonprofit financial management, she never thought she'd be brought to tears by a board member questioning her competence. But here she was. Finally, sick of feeling attacked each time she presented the budget numbers, she decided to confront the board member, a woman named Sylvie. It did not go well. Janet explains.
Looking back, although I was saying some of the right things, taking responsibility for my contribution and so forth, I think what I really wanted to do was tell her off. I wanted her to feel as small as I had, and I wanted her to know that she couldn't treat me this way. Oh, I let her have it, and I walked out of the meeting feeling great for about 15 minutes. Then I started to regret some of the things I'd said and realized I just made the situation worse by feeding the antagonism between us. The fact was, she could treat me this way, and I'd just made it more likely that she would.
If your purpose is to change the other person or their behavior, to vent or tell them off, then having this conversation is quite likely to produce many of the negative consequences you fear. Attempting this conversation is likely to make things worse rather than better. This is not to say that Janet is stuck being mistreated by Sylvie without any way to address the situation. Janet might have a constructive conversation with Sylvie if she can shift her purposes a bit. If Janet can negotiate herself into a place of curiosity about why Sylvie reacts as she does, this could be a worthwhile conversation. Janet can see it as an opportunity to learn Sylvie's story, to share her own, and then to figure out how they might work together better. Is it something Janet is doing? Is Sylvie aware of the impact she's having on Janet? Is this the way Sylvie has gotten results in the past? What advice can Janet offer Sylvie on how to get a better reaction out of her? If Janet can come into the conversation with this kind of curiosity stance toward Sylvie's view, the conversation is much less likely to provoke a bad reaction or to damage the relationship. Janet, in fact, would be investing in the relationship by trying to work with Sylvie and figuring out why things have been so difficult. Negotiating with yourself to shift your purposes can lower the threshold of how risky the conversation is likely to be and improve the odds of a constructive outcome. Often, when we have something important to say, we say it now because now is when it's causing us frustration. Most of us are thoughtful enough to avoid the most egregious errors of bad timing. If someone tells us they've just returned from the doctor's office and are going to have an operation after all, few of us would say, "I'm sorry to hear that. Oh, by the way, you still owe me $500. There's another error around timing that we do make, however. It's called the hit and run. An employee wanders into work late, something you've been meaning to talk to them about. So you say, "Late again, eh?" and leave it at that. Or you visit your son for the weekend, notice the empty beer bottles in the garbage, and say, "I see you're still drinking up a storm." These comments are intended to help. You hope your employee or your son will take the message to heart. But while your comments may help you feel a bit better, at least I've said something, you think, they make the other person defensive and frustrated, which is unlikely to produce the kind of change you had in mind. A good rule to follow is, if you're going to talk, talk. Really talk. And if you're really going to talk, you can't do it on the fly. You have to plan a time to talk. You have to be explicit about wanting 10 minutes or an hour to discuss something that is important to you. You can't have a real conversation in 30 seconds, and anything less than a real conversation isn't going to help. If hit and run is all you can muster, it's better not to raise the issue at all. The approach in this program can help you accomplish a number of surprising results. You'll make better decisions about when bringing something up just doesn't make sense, at least until you've sorted through some of your own issues or tried changing your own contribution. And when you choose to engage, you'll slowly get better at staying out of your own way, spotting and sidestepping the ways you used to trip yourself up. Over time, you'll lessen your own anxiety and deepen your most important relationships. This approach is not magic. Sometimes, despite our very best efforts, nothing helps. You can't force the other person to want to invest in the relationship or work things out. No matter how many times you explain to your son how worried you are when he doesn't call, he may not call. Your boss may continue to lose his temper. Your mother may never come to understand how emotionally abandoned you felt when you were young. Sometimes you consider your purposes and some possible strategies and decide not to have the conversation. Holding on to the issues inside the relationship becomes too painful or exhausting, so you move on. You are able to let go. Other times, it's not that easy. For one reason or another, even though you think it's the better choice not to engage with the issue, the situation has you by the throat. The story inside your head still carries emotional punch. You experience a flood of emotions every time you think about it. You've decided to move on, but your emotions have dug in their heels. Some people say letting go is a choice. Others think it happens only when the conditions are right, after contrition has been shown, after you've found a new relationship, or after you've been forgiven. What does it take to be able truly to let go? To open your palm and let the bitterness and exasperation and hurt and shame sift through your fingers? We don't presume to know. And we're suspicious of anyone who thinks there's an easy formula. Probably it's something different for each of us. What we do know is that letting go usually takes time, and that it is rarely a simple journey. It's not easy to find a place where we can set free the pain or shame we carry from our experiences. A place where we can tell the story differently in our heads, where we can relinquish the role of victim or villain and give ourselves and them roles that are more complex and liberating. If someone tells you that you should have gotten over something or someone by now, don't believe it. But neither should you believe that there's nothing you can do to enable yourself to let go or that it just takes time. There's plenty you can do to help yourself down that road. A good place to start is in the identity conversation, challenging some of the common assumptions that can get in the way of letting go and being at peace with our choices. Four more realistic and liberating assumptions are, first, it's not my responsibility to make things better. It's my responsibility to do my best. For Karenna, the key to closure was letting go of the fantasy that things could be better.
I failed at relationships before, and so I wanted this one to work. But I didn't just want it to work. Somewhere along the line, I decided it had to work, no matter what, and that it was my job to make it happen. I tried everything, and maybe I should have gotten out of the relationship sooner. But it was hard to let go of the idea that things between me and Paul might have worked out, if only I'd been a better person, or said the right thing at the right time, or worked harder at it, or something.
In Karenna's situation, part of the process of letting go of the guilt and sadness she carried was accepting that sometimes there are limits. You cannot always make a relationship more comfortable or more nourishing or more intimate or more durable. The best you can do is to try. Second, they have limitations too. Sometimes you'll tell the other person about your feelings and perspectives or about the impact they are having on you, and they say they understand and you each agree to change your behavior. Then they do what annoys you yet again, and you think, well, now they know this aggravates me, so what's the story? Am I not important enough to them? Are they trying to drive me nuts? What am I to make of this? One thing you can make of it is that they are as imperfect as you are. No matter how clearly you share how much their drinking hurts you, their forgetfulness aggravates you, or their unresponsiveness saddens you, they may not have the capacity to be different, at least not right now. Third, this conflict is not who I am. An important barrier to letting go occurs when we integrate the conflict into our sense of who we are. In our mind's eye, we are the least favorite son, the long-suffering wife, part of the oppressed group. We define ourselves in relation to our conflict with others. Over the last 4 years, the leadership in Rob's firm has split over several key strategic questions. Part of the losing faction, Rob's professional identity has been all but consumed by being one of the few still holding out, standing up to management. Now, in the wake of a sudden merger, Rob's faction has been handed control, and the satisfaction he feels is mingled with uneasiness. No longer playing the opposition, Rob is not sure how to see himself. Rob's sense of self was perhaps too aligned with his role in the conflict. Such dynamics play an important part in ethnic conflict. Our sense of who we are as a community is often defined in terms of who we are not, who we are against, and what hardships we've endured. Tragically, we can feel threatened by the prospect of reconciliation, because it can rob us not only of our role, but also of our communal identity. These kinds of situations are notoriously difficult to manage, because we don't want to give up who we are unless there's something better to replace it. If you find yourself being swallowed up by a conflict, if you begin to see your very identity as tied to the fight, try to take a step back and remember why you were fighting. You were fighting for what is right and fair, not because you need the conflict to survive. Fourth, letting go doesn't mean we no longer care. Often we are unable to let go because we fear that if we do, it will mean we no longer care. If you and your sister weren't at odds, how would you show how important she is to you, or know that you're just as significant in her life? Is it possible to let go and still care enormously? Letting go of the emotions and identity issues wrapped up in a difficult conversation can be one of the most challenging things you do. Difficult conversations operate at the core of our being, where the people and the principles we care about most intersect with our self-image and our self-esteem. Letting go, at heart, is about how to handle with skill and grace not having a difficult conversation. Of course, the better you become at engaging in difficult conversations, the less there will be for you to let go of. One key to improving is having sound purposes. We've talked about purposes that will get you into trouble. But how about purposes that make sense? The gold standard here is working for mutual understanding. Not mutual agreement, necessarily, but a better understanding of each of your stories, so that you can make informed decisions, alone or together, about what to do next. Anytime you think a conversation might be difficult, keep these three purposes front and center in your consciousness. The first purpose is learning their story. Exploring the other person's perspective takes us into each of the three conversations. What information do they see that we missed or don't have access to? What past experiences influenced them? What is their reasoning for why they did what they did? What were their intentions? How did our actions impact them? What do they think we are contributing to the problem? What are they feeling? What does this situation mean to them? How does it affect their identity? What's at stake? The second purpose is expressing your views and feelings. Your goal should be to express your views and feelings to your own satisfaction. You hope that the other person will understand what you are saying and perhaps be moved by it, but you can't count on that. What you can do is say as well as you can what is important for you to say about your views, intentions, contributions, feelings, and identity issues. You can share your story. The third purpose is problem-solving together. Given what you and the other person have each learned, what would improve the situation going forward? Can you brainstorm creative ways to satisfy both of your needs? Where your needs conflict, can you use equitable standards to ensure a fair and workable way to resolve the conflict? These three purposes accommodate the fact that you and the other person see the world differently, that you each have powerful feelings about what is going on, and that you each have your own identity issues to work through. Each of you, in short, has your own story. You need purposes that can reckon with this reality. These are the purposes that emerge from a learning stance, from working through the three conversations and shifting your internal orientation from certainty to curiosity, from debate to exploration, from simplicity to complexity, from either or to and. They may seem simple, perhaps even simplistic. But their straightforwardness masks both the difficulty involved in doing them well and the power they have to transform the way you handle your conversations. Working from a learning stance with these purposes in mind, the rest of this program explores in detail how to conduct a learning conversation, from getting started to getting unstuck.
Getting started. Begin from the third story. The most stressful moment of a difficult conversation is often the beginning. We may learn in the first few seconds that the news for us is not good, that the other person sees things very differently, that we aren't likely to get what we want. They may become angry or distraught, or we may discover that they don't want to talk to us at all. But while the beginning is fraught with peril, it is also an opportunity. It's when you have the greatest leverage to influence the entire direction of the conversation. Sure, you can begin in a way that sends things careening into a brick wall. We've all done that. But it doesn't have to go that way. What you say at the outset can put you squarely on the road toward understanding and problem solving. How to begin a conversation? Let's first consider how not to.
If you can test Dad's will, it's going to tear the family apart.
I was very upset by what you said in front of our supervisor.
Your son Nathan can be difficult in class, disruptive and argumentative. You've said in the past that things at home are fine, but something must be troubling him.
Before we know it, we're in over our heads. The other person becomes hurt or angry, we feel defensive, our preparation goes out the window, and we wonder why we thought having this conversation was a good idea in the first place. What went wrong? When we jump into conversations, we typically begin inside our story. We describe the problem from our perspective, and in doing so, trigger just the kinds of reactions we hope to avoid. We begin from precisely the place the other person thinks is causing the problem. If they agreed with our story, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation in the first place. Our story invariably, although often unintentionally, communicates a judgment about them, the kind of person they are, and the fact that, inside our version of events, they are the problem. Something as simple as an opening sentence can give us away. Let's take a look at a line we just cited. If you contest Dad's will, it's going to tear the family apart. Contains an implicit message. You're unselfish, ungrateful, and obviously don't care about the family. This triggers the other person's identity conversation from the outset, and there's no room in our agenda for their story. It's natural that they would reject our version and want to get their own on the table. I'm not trying to tear the family apart. I'm just sticking up for what Dad wanted and for what's fair. By leaving their story out, we implicitly set up a trade-off between their version of events and our version, between our feelings and theirs. The question is what to do instead. We offer two powerful guidelines for starting the conversation off in the right direction. First, begin the conversation from the third story. And second, offer an invitation to explore the issues jointly. In addition to your story and the other person's story, every difficult conversation includes an invisible third story. The third story is the one a keen observer would tell, someone with no stake in your particular problem. For example, in the battle between bicycles and cars for the streets of the city, the third story would be the one told by city planners, who can understand each side's concerns and see why each group is frustrated with the other. When tensions arise in a marriage, the third story might be the one offered by a marriage counselor. The urban planner and marriage counselor each have the vantage point of a neutral observer or mediator. Mediators are third parties who help people solve their problems by helping the two sides communicate more effectively and to explore possible ways of moving forward. One of the most helpful tools a mediator has is the ability to identify this invisible third story. This means describing the problem between the parties in a way that rings true for both sides simultaneously. Mediators don't possess some magical intuition that allows them to do this. They are relying on a formula, and lots of practice, and this formula can be learned by anyone. The key is learning to describe the gap, or difference, between your story and the other person's story. Whatever else you may think and feel, you can at least agree that you and the other person see things differently. Consider an example. Jason's roommate Jill leaves dishes in the sink for days on end. This drives Jason crazy and means that he ends up doing much of the cleaning up since he can't stand to let them sit. In the past, Jason has raised the issue with Jill by saying, "Do I have to do everything around here? You can't let dishes sit this long. It's a health risk." Obviously, Jason is speaking from inside his story. Jill is not going to be thrilled with this start to the conversation, and will likely respond by defending herself or attacking Jason. This would be true even if Jason began with more tact, offering something like, "Jill, we need to talk about your problem with getting the dishes done." Tact or not, it's still his story. If Jill were to raise the problem, she would begin differently. "Jason, we need to talk about the fact that you're so annoyingly anal about the dishes. Last night you practically cleared the table before I was finished eating. You need to relax." This, of course, suits Jill, but not Jason. The third story would remove the judgment from the description and instead describe the problem as a difference between Jason and Jill. It might go like this. Jason and Jill have different preferences around when the dishes are done, and different standards for what constitutes appropriate or obsessive cleanliness. Each is unhappy with the other's approach. That's how a mediator, or an observant friend, might describe the problem. And both Jason and Jill can sign on to this difference. Clearly, there is a difference, and in the third story, there is no judgment about who is right or even whose view is more common. The third story simply captures the difference. That's what allows both sides to buy into the same description of the problem. Each feels that their story is acknowledged as a legitimate part of the discussion. Once you find it, you can begin from the third story yourself. So Jason might say, "Jill, you and I seem to have different preferences about when the dishes get done, or beliefs about when they should be done. I wonder if that's something we could talk about." Jason can offer that without sacrificing his own views. Soon enough, he'll ask about Jill's story and describe his own, and Jill can sign on without defensiveness. Importantly, you don't have to know what the other person's story entails to include it in initiating the conversation this way. All you have to do is acknowledge that it's there, that there are probably lots of things that you don't understand about their perspective, and that one of the reasons you want to talk is that you want to learn more about their view. Consider the opening we looked at earlier, "If you contest Dad's will, it's going to tear our family apart," and how that might sound if begun from the third story.
"I wanted to talk about Dad's will. You and I obviously have different understandings of what Dad intended and of what's fair to each of us. I want to understand why you see things the way you do, and I really want to share with you my perspective and feelings. Also, I have strong feelings and fears about what a court fight would mean for the family. I suspect you do too."
Stepping out of your story doesn't mean giving up your point of view. Your purpose in opening the conversation is to invite the other person into a joint exploration. In the course of that exploration, you'll spend time in each side's perspective, and then come back to adjust your own views based on what you've learned and what you've shared. After talking with your brother about how you each think your father's estate should be divided, where those views come from, and how you feel about the current conflict, it may be that your view of what's fair changes. Your brother's view may also shift, and the two of you may find a way to settle the issue that feels fair to both of you. Or the two of you may still disagree. But even if you disagree on the substance of the dispute, you've had the chance to express how upsetting and sad and worrisome the conflict is for you, and to gain a deeper understanding of why your brother sees it as he does. You may even be able to find a process for working through the differences while protecting your family relationships from being ravaged by a nasty fight. You won't always have the chance to reflect on how you want to begin the conversation and then be the one who actually initiates it. Sometimes difficult conversations will simply descend upon you, presenting themselves in your office or on your doorstep, whether you are ready for them or not. You can follow the third story guidelines even when you are not the initiator of the conversation. Here's what you do. You take whatever the other person says and use it as their half of a description from the third story. Since the third story includes their story, starting the conversation with their view doesn't mean you're off track. For instance, if Jill comes to Jason and says, "We need to talk about how you ruin all our meals by being so obsessive about the dishes," Jason might find himself wanting to respond from inside his story. "What? You're the one with the problem. You're the biggest slob I know." But if he does, he'll send the conversation headlong toward that brick wall. Instead, Jason can treat Jill's opening as her part of the third story. He might say, "It sounds like you're pretty unhappy with how I handle the dishes. I have trouble with how you deal with the dishes too, so I think we each have different preferences and assumptions around that. It seems like that would be a good thing for us to talk about." Jason has not only acknowledged Jill's story as an important part of the conversation, but has also included his own as part of the process of understanding the problem. And importantly, in doing so, Jason has succeeded in shifting the purpose of the conversation from arguing toward understanding. The second step in getting off to a good start is to offer a simple invitation. "I've described the problem in a way we can each accept. Now I want to propose mutual understanding and problem solving as purposes. Check to see if this makes sense to you, and to invite you to join me in a conversation." If the other person is going to accept your invitation, they need to know what it is they're agreeing to do. Letting them know up front that your goal for the discussion is to understand their perspective better, to share your own, and to talk about how to go forward together makes the conversation significantly less mysterious and threatening, and more likely that they will accept your invitation. Remember, though, an invitation can be turned down. If you conceptualize your task as setting the description of the problem and the purposes for the conversation, even a well-crafted opening may meet with some resistance, because this is now your version of the third story. Think of your goal rather as offering and discussing a possible description and purpose for the conversation. In other words, the task of describing the problem and of setting purposes is in itself a joint task. Your invitation is more likely to be accepted if you offer the other person an appealing role in managing the conversation. You need to sidestep the temptation to cast them as the problem, or in an unappealing light, since this will trigger their identity conversation and stop the conversation cold. So if, in a stalled contract negotiation, you were to say, "I can see we have different ideas about what salary makes sense here. So far, so good." But if you then add, "And since you're new at this, I can tell you how it's usually done," you cast them as the neophyte and sink the ship. The role you offer has to be genuine, and sometimes the most genuine thing you can do is to share your internal struggle to cast them in a more positive role. You can say something like, "You know, the story I'm telling in my head about what's going on has you being inconsiderate. At some level, I know that's unfair to you, and I need you to help me put things in better perspective. I need you to help me understand where you're coming from on this." It's honest, and at the same time offers them a role of someone who can help me get my perspective back. Finally, it may be necessary to be persistent. It may take a little work to help them understand what it is you are proposing. Ruth wants to have a conversation with her ex-husband Brian about the time he spends with their daughter, Alexis. In the past, their conversations have resulted in fights. This time, Ruth begins from the third story and offers some useful purposes. Even so, it takes some negotiating to get her ex-husband to understand.
"Brian, it seems to me that we're having a hard time being clear with each other about how likely it is that you'll make it for your time with Lexi."
I know. I'm sorry, okay? We had a crisis on the shop floor, and I was tied up in a meeting trying to address it.
I understand that things sometimes come up. I guess I was thinking about the bigger picture, since there have been several times in the last few months when I thought we'd confirm plans for you to spend the day with Lexi, and later learned that you understood our plans to be more tentative. You thought the plan was that you'd come by if you could get away.
That was what I said. If I could get away, I'd visit.
See? And I thought we'd agreed to a definite plan that you'd be here no matter what. So you and I are misunderstanding each other. I'd like to sort this out because it's awfully hard on Alexis when you and I get our signals crossed. Can we spend some time trying to figure this thing out?
I think that makes sense. I don't want to upset Lexi.
Notice that Brian didn't accept, or perhaps even understand, Ruth's description of the problem or purposes at the beginning. He expected to be yelled at for not showing up, and reacted accordingly. But Ruth does a nice job of being both persistent and open to Brian's response. In addition to the general advice to open the conversation from the third story, we can offer more specific advice on getting started depending on the nature of the difficult conversation you are anticipating. As we said earlier, even delivering bad news should be a conversation, and it's usually best to put the bad news up front. Don't try to trick the other person into saying it first, asking, for example, "So, what do you think of the relationship?" when what you mean is, "I want to break up." And don't talk for 2 hours about some of the issues you've been having with the relationship if you know that in the end, what you want to do is break up. Some difficult conversations center on our desire to get something. A common example is asking for a raise. How to begin? The simple advice about making requests is this: don't make it a demand. Instead, invite an exploration of whether a raise is fair, whether it makes sense. That's not being unassertive. It's being in better touch with reality. Your boss has information about you and your colleagues that you don't have. It may sound like nitpicking, but in fact you can't know that you deserve a raise until you've explored the issue with your boss. At some level, you know this, which is one of the big reasons asking for a raise causes anxiety. Try replacing "I think I deserve a raise" with "I'd like to explore whether a raise for me might make sense. From the information I have, I think I deserve one." You'll want to explain your reasoning for why you think you deserve one, and then ask, "I wonder how you see it." This seemingly small change in how you begin should not only reduce stress, but also get the conversation off on an even keel. In the end, you may learn that you don't deserve a raise, or that you deserve an even bigger one than you initially thought you did. Sometimes you know, perhaps from past experience, that the other person is likely to react negatively the minute you raise an especially sensitive topic. Your son doesn't want to talk about his grades. Your wife doesn't want to talk about the finances. And the minute you raise the question of racism in the department, your colleagues roll their eyes. How can you open a more constructive conversation when conversations haven't gone well in the past, and the simple fact of raising the old issue casts you as the nag? The easiest approach is first to talk about how to talk. Treat the way things usually go when we try to have this conversation as the problem, and describe it from the third story. You might do this by saying, "I know that in the past when I've raised the question of who's getting promoted and what role race plays in that process, people have sometimes felt accused or exasperated. I don't mean to accuse anyone or to make people feel uncomfortable. At the same time, it feels important to me to discuss. I'm wondering whether we could talk about how we each react to that conversation and whether there's a better way we could address these issues." Beginning from the third story gets you safely to the base of the mountain. But then there's the mountain itself to climb. Once a description of the problem is on the table and your purposes are clear, then you will need to spend time exploring the three conversations from each of your perspectives. The other person will share their views and feelings, and you'll step back into your story and share yours. As you share your stories, each of the three conversations offers a useful path to explore. You can talk about the past experiences that have led each of you to see the current situation the way you do. You know, I think the reason I reacted so strongly is that the last time we didn't receive payment from a vendor, the situation only went from bad to worse. You can ask about the other person's intentions and share the impact of their behavior on you. I don't know whether you realize this or not, but when you didn't call, I was frantic with worry. You can empathize with how they might be feeling. If I were you, I'd be pretty frustrated at this point. Or you can share what's going on with your identity conversation. I think the reason I find this so hard is that being fair is so important to me. It's upsetting to think that the way I handled this situation might not have been fair to you. Ultimately, what you choose to share will depend upon the context and the relationship and what feels appropriate and helpful. The three conversations provide a useful map for what to talk about. The next few sections delve more deeply into how to talk about it. To be able to see the other person's story from the inside, you'll need some specific skills in inquiring, listening, and acknowledgement. To share your own story with clarity and power, you will need to feel entitled and be precise in speaking only for yourself. Of course, it will never be as tidy as moving simply from the third story to their story to your story. A real conversation is an interactive process, one where you are constantly going to be listening, sharing your view, asking questions, and negotiating to get the conversation back on track when it starts to go off the rails. During the remainder of this program, we'll be providing guidance on how to manage this interactive process and how to move toward problem solving. Finally, we will return to our original story of Jack and Michael and offer an extended example illustrating how it all works in practice.
Learning. Listen from the inside out. Andrew is visiting his Uncle Doug. While Doug is on the phone, Andrew tugs on his uncle's pant leg, saying, "Uncle Doug, I want to go outside."
"Not now, Andrew. I'm on the phone," says Doug.
Andrew persists,
"But Uncle Doug, I want to go outside."
"Not now, Andrew," comes Doug's response.
"But I want to go outside," Andrew repeats.
After several more rounds, Doug tries a different approach. "Hey, Andrew, you really want to go outside, don't you?"
"Yeah," says Andrew.
And then without further comment, Andrew walks off and begins playing by himself. Andrew, it turns out, just wanted to know that his uncle understood him. He wanted to know he'd been heard. Andrew's story demonstrates something that is true for all of us. We have a deep desire to feel heard and to know that others care enough to listen. Some people think they are already good listeners. Others know they are not, but don't much care. If you're in either group, you might be tempted to skip this section. Don't. Listening well is one of the most powerful skills you can bring to a difficult conversation. It helps you understand the other person, and importantly, it helps them understand you. A year ago, Greta's mother learned she had diabetes and was ordered to follow a strict regimen of medication, diet, and exercise. Greta is concerned that her mother is not following the regimen, but Greta has had little success encouraging her mother to do so. A typical conversation between them goes like this.
"Mom, you need to stay on the exercise plan. I worry that you don't understand how important it is."
"Greta, please stop hounding me about this. You don't understand. I'm doing the best I can."
"Mom, I do understand. I know exercising can be difficult, but I want you to stay well. I want you to be around for your grandchildren."
"Greta, I really don't like these conversations. It's all very hard for me. The diet, the exercise."
"I know it's hard. Exercising is no fun, but the thing is, after a week or two, it gets easier. You'll start to look forward to it. We can find you some activity that you'll really enjoy."
"You don't realize. It's very stressful. I'm just not going to talk about it anymore. That's all there is to it."
Not surprisingly, these conversations leave Greta feeling frustrated, powerless, and deeply sad. Greta wonders how she might be more assertive, how she can persuade her mother to change. But assertiveness isn't Greta's problem. What's missing from her stance is curiosity. In a follow-up conversation, Greta shifts her goal from persuasion to learning. To do this, she limits herself to listening, asking questions, and acknowledging her mother's feelings.
I know you don't like talking about your diabetes and exercising.
I really don't. It's very upsetting to me.
When you say upsetting, what do you mean? What are you thinking of?
Greta, the whole thing. Do you think it's fun for me?
No, Mom, I know it's really hard. I guess I don't know very much about how you think about it, what it means to you, or how you feel about it.
I'll tell you, if your father were alive, it would be different. He was so sweet when I would get sick. Having to follow all these complicated rules, that's what he would have been good at. He would have taken care of the whole thing. Being sick, it just makes me miss him so much.
It sounds like you're feeling really lonely without Dad.
I have friends, and you've been wonderful, but it's not the same as having your father here to help. I suppose I really do feel lonely, but I hate to talk about that. I don't want to be a burden on you kids.
So you feel like if you tell us you were lonely, that you'd be a burden? You mean that we'd worry about you?
I just don't want you to have to go through what my mother went through. You know, her mother died of diabetes.
I didn't know. Wow.
It's scary to be told you have what your grandmother died of. It's hard for me to accept. I know the medications are better now, which is why I should be following all those rules. But if I follow all those rules, it just makes me feel like some sick old lady.
So keeping to the regimen would feel like accepting something that you're not really totally accepting yet?
It's irrational. I'm not saying it's not. It's just very frightening and overwhelming.
I know it is, Mom.
I'll tell you something else. I don't even understand what I'm supposed to be doing. The eating, the exercise. If you do one, it affects the other, and you have to keep track. It's complicated, and the doctor isn't terribly helpful in explaining it. I don't know where to begin. Your father would know.
Well, maybe that's something I could help you with.
Greta, I don't want to be a burden.
I want to help. It would actually make me feel better. Not so powerless.
Well, if you could, that would take a big load off my mind.
Greta was astonished and delighted at how much better her conversations became after she began truly listening to her mother. She came to see the issues from her mother's point of view, how much deeper they ran than she suspected, and how she might be able to help her mother in ways that her mother wanted to be helped. This is perhaps the most obvious benefit of listening, learning about the other person. But there's a second, more surprising benefit as well. Ironically, when Greta shifts away from trying to persuade her mother to exercise and towards simply listening and acknowledging, she ends up achieving the goal that had eluded her up to that point. She gets her mother to listen to her. This is not an accident. One of the most common complaints we hear from people engaged in difficult conversations is that the other person won't listen. And when we hear that, our standard advice is, you need to spend more time listening to them. When the other person is not listening, you may imagine it's because they're stubborn or don't understand what you're trying to say. If they did, after all, they'd understand why they should listen. So you may try to break through that by repeating yourself, trying new ways to explain yourself, talking more loudly, and so forth. On the face of it, these would seem to be good strategies. But they're not. Why? Because in the great majority of cases, the reason the other person is not listening to you is not because they're stubborn, but because they don't feel heard. In other words, they aren't listening to you for the same reason you aren't listening to them. They think you are slow or stubborn. So they repeat themselves, find new ways to say things, talk more loudly, and so forth. If the block to their listening is that they don't feel heard, then the way to remove that block is by helping them feel heard by bending over backwards to listen to what they have to say. And perhaps most important, by demonstrating that you understand what they are saying and how they are feeling. If you don't quite believe this, try it. Find the most stubborn person you know, the person who never seems to take in anything you say, the person who repeats himself or herself in every conversation you ever have, and listen to them. Especially, listen for feelings like frustration or pride or fear, and acknowledge those feelings. See whether they don't become a better listener after all. What specifically does Greta do differently in the second conversation? She asks questions. She paraphrases what her mother says to make sure she understands it, and to make sure her mother understands that Greta understands. Greta is also listening for the feelings that might be behind what her mother is saying and acknowledges them when she hears them. Each of these is enormously important to good listening, but none is enough. The single most important thing Greta has done is to shift her internal stance from "I understand" to "help me understand." Everything else follows from that. Scores of workshops and books on active listening teach you what you should do to be a good listener. Their advice is relatively similar. Ask questions, paraphrase back what the other person has said, acknowledge their view, sit attentively and look them in the eye. All good advice. You emerge from these courses eager to try out your new skills, only to become discouraged when your friends and colleagues complain that you sound phony or mechanical. "Don't use that active listening stuff on me," they say. The problem is this. You're taught what to say and how to sit, but the heart of good listening is authenticity. People read not only your words and posture, but what's going on inside of you. If your stance isn't genuine, the words won't matter. What will be communicated almost invariably is whether you are genuinely curious, whether you genuinely care about the other person. If your intentions are false, no amount of careful wording or good posture will help. If your intentions are good, even clumsy language won't hinder you. Listening is only powerful and effective if it's authentic. Authenticity means that you're listening because you're curious and because you care, not just because you're supposed to listen. The issue then is this. Are you curious? Do you really care? You can tell what's going on inside of you by listening to yourself, finding and paying attention to your own internal voice. What you're thinking but not saying is the crucial first step in overcoming the biggest barrier to inauthentic listening. Left unattended, that voice blocks good listening. To the extent you're listening to your own internal voice, you're at best only half listening to the other person. Take a moment to locate the commentator in your head. It's saying something like, this internal voice is an interesting concept. Or, what are they talking about? I don't have an internal voice. That, by the way, is your internal voice. Perhaps surprisingly, our advice is not to turn off your internal voice or even to turn it down. You can't. Instead, we urge you to do the opposite. Turn up your internal voice, at least for the time being, and listen to the kinds of things it says. Only when you're fully aware of your own internal thoughts can you begin to manage them and focus on the other person. There are endless thoughts and feelings you might have while you're listening, and by now you know the patterns. Your voice will be chattering away in each of the three conversations. In the "what happened" conversation, you'll find yourself thinking things like, "I'm right," "I didn't intend to hurt you," and "this wasn't my fault." You'll also notice plenty of feelings. "I can't believe she thinks that about me. I'm so furious." And identity issues. "Was I really that thoughtless? I couldn't have been." Or, not uncommonly, you may simply be daydreaming. I wonder if there's enough meatloaf for the in-laws. Or beginning to prepare your own response. Boy, when it's my turn, there are 4 points I'm going to make. No wonder the person you're listening to doesn't feel they have your full attention. How can you give the other person your full attention and listen with curiosity when your internal commentator is chattering away? You can try 2 things. First, see if you can negotiate your way to curiosity. See if you can get your internal voice into a learning mode. If this doesn't work, and sometimes it won't, you may first have to express your internal voice before trying to listen to the other person. It's a mistake to think your internal voice can't change. If you find your curiosity failing, you can work to rev it up. Remind yourself that the task of understanding the other person's world is always harder than it seems. Remind yourself that if you think you already understand how someone else feels or what they're trying to say, it's a delusion. Remember a time when you were sure you were right, and then discovered one little fact that changed everything. There's always more to learn. Remind yourself